Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 443, titled The Serpent's Diaries, Part 2, subtitled Neo-Nazis and 9/11. This program is being recorded on January 25th of the year 2004, and recall, of course, WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs for download only on a longer URL linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and to the Real Audio equipped For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Within a week or so of the airing of this program, there will be a detailed, annotated description of For the Record program number 443 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Listeners have inquired about how they can help to support the work that I'm doing. At the beginning of each For the Record description, there is a page that you can click on in order to pursue that in greater detail. Now, we're going to return to the article that we were looking at the conclusion of side one of this program. The general focus of this program are evidentiary tributaries running between the neo-Nazi milieu of the Aryan Nations and the National Alliance, the milieu of the Turner Diaries, the first World Trade Center attack in 1993, the Oklahoma City bombing, the anthrax attacks that followed September 11th, and the September 11th attack. We're going to resume with an examination of an article that we looked at in For the Record 373 and also 380. It's called The Terrorist Motel by Jim Crogan, C-R-O-G-A-N. This is from the LA Weekly of July 26th through August 1st of 2002. This motel, the so-called terrorist motel, is a motel at which, apparently, members of the September 11th hijack team, also, allegedly, Zaharias Moussaoui, the alleged 20th hijacker, and also the Oklahoma City bombers, including Timothy McVeigh, stayed. Things of importance here are that, first of all, if this account is true, it connects Mohammed Atta and Zaharias Moussaoui in a concrete way. It also links someone who knew Moussaoui and stuck up for him, and that person, whom we will talk about in a minute, was present at this motel prior to the Oklahoma City bombing in 1994 and 1995. Also, people at the motel recall Timothy McVeigh being in the presence of Middle Eastern nationals. They were superficially identified as Iraqis. I would take that with a grain of salt. But they may have been Iraqis who had been recruited by the Al-Qaeda milieu in order to specifically provoke conflict between the United States and Iraq and to exacerbate conflict between the United States and the Muslim peoples of what the Third Reich referred to as the Earth Island. Again, from The Terrorist Motel by Jim Crogan, LA Weekly, July 26th through August 1st of 2002. What happened at the nondescript roadside motel outside Oklahoma City was just a fleeting encounter during the twisted cross-country odyssey of the terrorists who would carry out the September 11th attacks. Mohammed Atta, alleged leader of the plot, and two companions wanted to rent a room, but couldn't get the deal they wanted, so they left. It was an incident of no particular importance except for one thing. The owner of the motel remembers Atta being in the company of Zaharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, who was arrested prior to September 11th and now faces conspiracy charges in connection with the terror assaults. If this recollection is correct, the entire incident and its absence from the public record raises new questions about the FBI investigation of Moussaoui and even the 1995 destruction of the federal building in Oklahoma City. Already, the FBI has endured a withering political and media critique for failing to aggressively investigate Moussaoui and his contacts during his 4 weeks in custody prior to the attacks in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Some FBI officials have responded by characterizing Moussaoui as only a minor player. But the report from the motel owner, if proven, could change that. And it also could force the FBI to reopen its investigation of Middle Eastern connections to the 1995 Oklahoma City blast, because convicted bombers Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols reportedly stayed at the same motel, interacting with a group of, quote, Iraqis or other Middle Eastern nationals during the weeks before the bombing. Skipping down. But that circus, that's the Zaharias Moussaoui circus, obscures a conundrum of a different sort. The government's case, outlined in its new 6-count conspiracy indictment, is largely circumstantial, lacking any definitive link between Moussaoui and the 19 hijackers identified by federal authorities. All of which makes the apparent shelving of the Moussaoui-Atta sighting all the stranger. In fact, even though multiple sources contend that the FBI interviewed the motel owner, there's no indication that prosecutors were told. It's possible that the FBI found the motel owner's identifications wrong or his story unreliable, but it's still odd that in interviews with The Weekly, Justice Department prosecutors seem to know nothing about the motel encounter, especially because agents reportedly told the motel owner they would pass the information on to Moussaoui's defense. The motel co-owner, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said the incident occurred around August 1, 2001, just 6 weeks before September 11th. They came in around 10 or 11 a.m. and started talking to my desk clerk, he said. Even though he was working about 10 feet away from the trio, the owner didn't really pay any attention at first. They were asking my clerk, who no longer works here, about a weekly rate for our rooms. The former clerk could not be reached for comment. The motel, explained the owner, sets aside some rooms with small kitchenettes to rent on a weekly basis, but they were all taken. He said the clerk explained the situation, but the visitors were persistent. Finally, my clerk asked me to talk to them. The motel owner said that Moussaoui and a man who appeared to be Marwan al-Shehhi, who helped crash a jetliner into the south tower of the World Trade Center, were friendly and said a few things, but Atta was clearly the leader. He did most of the talking and seemed very serious, said the owner, adding, quote, I was standing face-to-face about 2 feet away from Atta and talked to the three of them for about 10 minutes. Atta asked if he could rent one of the other rooms at a weekly rate, and I told him no. I asked him what they were doing here in the area, and Atta told me they were going to flight school. I thought he meant Federal Aviation Administration training in Oklahoma City, but Atta told me no, they were taking flight training in Norman. I said I didn't understand why they wanted to rent one of my rooms, since we were about 28 miles from Norman, and there are a lot of reasonably priced motels a lot closer. But he said they had heard good things about my place and wanted to stay there. I told them I was sorry, but we couldn't accommodate them, and Atta finally said, okay. Then they all thanked me for my time and left. After the attack, said the motel owner, he recognized his visitor in photos from television reports. I was really stunned, he said. Then he decided to call the FBI hotline. The motel owner said he didn't hear right back from the FBI. In the interim, he also spoke to a former law enforcement officer who was investigating reported sites of Mujahid Abdul Qadir Meneptpa, M-E-N-E-P-T-A, at the same motel during the mid-1990s. Meneptpa, reportedly a friend of Moussaoui's, was arrested 30 years ago in Colorado for aggravated robbery and served more than 3 years in prison. After September 11th, Meneptpa publicly defended Moussaoui, calling him a scapegoat, unquote. The FBI arrested him as a material witness and subsequently charged Meneptpa with a federal gun violation. He pleaded guilty and in April of 2002 was sentenced to 15 months in federal prison. He was never charged with any terrorism-related crime, but during the preliminary hearing on the gun charge, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms agent Jeffrey Whitney testified that a confidential source placed Meneptpa at a meeting of a radical Islamic group in St. Louis, where he allegedly threatened to shoot any police officer who entered the mosque. Meneptpa's attorney challenged the credibility of this report in court. A former desk clerk at the motel, a different clerk from the one who purportedly dealt with Atta and Moussaoui, told The Weekly that he remembered Meneptpa because in 1994 and 1995, prior to the Oklahoma City attack, Meneptpa frequently visited the motel office. There he bought coffee and talked for hours to this clerk. The clerk and his wife, who both formerly worked at the motel, said they picked Meneptpa's picture out of a photo lineup prepared by a law enforcement officer who had interviewed the motel owner. This officer, who also spoke to The Weekly on condition of anonymity, said that after the motel owner told him about the Moussaoui sighting, he contacted a member of Oklahoma's Joint Terrorism Task Force, which includes the FBI. The FBI finally acted on the tip. The motel owner said that on December 19, 2001, he went to FBI offices in Oklahoma City for a formal interview, where he was debriefed by an FBI agent and by Oklahoma City Police Sergeant Jerry Flowers. Quote, "We talked for several hours, and I told them everything I knew." The motel owner said he would have taken a polygraph exam, but was not asked to do so. The Weekly's law enforcement source corroborates the December 19th interview. The motel owner never heard from the prosecutors in Moussaoui's case, but got one more call from the FBI several weeks later. "The agent told me they had passed on a copy of my statement to Moussaoui's defense team, and I might be getting a call from them, but I was under no obligation to talk to them. However, I don't know if that was the truth. Since then, I've never heard from anyone connected to Moussaoui's case." Unquote. One reason for the FBI's apparent lack of interest might be this motel's alleged connection to Timothy McVeigh and a group of Iraqis, or parenthetically other Middle Eastern nationals, who worked in Oklahoma City. According to the motel owner and other witnesses and investigators interviewed by The Weekly, McVeigh and several of these, quote, Iraqis, unquote, were motel guests in the months preceding the 1995 bombing. Witnesses also claimed they saw several of the, quote, Iraqis, unquote, moving barrels of material around on the bed of a truck. The motel owner said the material smelled of diesel fuel, and he had to clean up a spill. Diesel fuel was a key component of the truck bomb that blew up the federal building, unquote. The motel owner said he and his staff reported this information to the FBI in 1995. "We did have an ATF agent come out and collect the originals of the room registrations for that period, but we never heard back from them. And I never could get the registrations returned." He added that his previous experience with the FBI made him reluctant to contact them about Moussaoui. Quote, "But I decided it was my duty to tell them what had happened, so I did," unquote. Former Oklahoma City TV reporter Jaina Davis also interviewed motel staff and former guests. In the process, she collected signed affidavits about their contacts with McVeigh and the, quote, Iraqis, unquote. She tried twice to give the Bureau this information, but the FBI refused to accept her materials. The Weekly first reported on her investigation in an article published in September of 2001. The Weekly's law enforcement source said he has reviewed Davis's material and considers it credible. Quote, "Last December, I personally took the documents to the Joint Terrorism Task Force," he said. Again quoting, "I told them they should do their own investigation." The response was not encouraging. He said he was later informed that the Bureau brought in an analyst, quote, "but I was told it would probably go nowhere. They were afraid the whole Oklahoma City bombing can of worms would be opened up, and the FBI would have to explain why they didn't investigate this material before." The Weekly contacted numerous local and federal investigators and agencies, including the Oklahoma Task Force, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, and the Justice Department. All declined to comment. Prosecutors on the Moussaoui case also declined official comment, but their reaction suggested they knew nothing of the motel encounter. After being told about the motel owner's interview and allegations, Assistant U.S. Attorney Robert Spencer responded with a one-word question about the sighting. When? Spencer then declined further comment. Another Moussaoui prosecutor, David Novak, also declined comment, but Novak wanted to know the name of the motel owner. Other substantial connections already tie the Sooner State to Moussaoui and separately several 9/11 hijackers. According to the Moussaoui indictment, on September 29, 2000, Moussaoui made email contact with Airman Flight School in Norman. Then on February 23, 2001, he flew from London to Chicago and then to Oklahoma City. What he did in the next few days is unknown, or at least not accounted for in the indictment. But on February 26, Moussaoui opened a bank account in Norman, depositing $32,000. From February 26 to May 29, he attended flight school in Norman. Then he suddenly quit the school. Between July 29th and August 4th, Moussaoui made calls from public payphones in Norman to Germany. On August 1st and 3rd, Ramzi bin al-Shib wired Moussaoui a total of about $14,000 from two train stops in Germany to somewhere in Oklahoma. This wire transfer does imply a connection to terrorist plotters because al-Shib, an alleged al-Qaeda member, wired money to other hijackers as well. On August 3rd, Moussaoui purchased two knives in Oklahoma City. And on August 10th or 11th, an acquaintance drove Moussaoui from Oklahoma to Minnesota for enrollment in a new flight school. Authorities arrested Moussaoui in Minnesota on August 17th on an immigration violation. As has been widely reported, Moussaoui attracted attention because he said he was interested in flying a plane, but not learning how to take off or land. He was in federal custody when the 9/11 attacks occurred. As for the terrorists who took part in 9/11, Atta and Marwan el-Shehhi visited the Airman Flight School in Norman in July of 2000, according to the Moussaoui indictment. The motel owner identifies al-Shehhi as the third person with Atta and Moussaoui when they allegedly inquired about a room. And on April 1, 2001, Nawaf al-Hazmi, who helped hijack American Airlines Flight 77, which crashed into the Pentagon, was stopped for speeding in Oklahoma and given two tickets. The Oklahoma State Trooper found no outstanding warrants and turned al-Hazmi loose. The media has since reported that the CIA had been tracking al-Hazmi, but never told the Immigration Service or the FBI that he was a suspected terrorist during his 21-month stay. Authorities have never publicly accounted for Atta and al-Shehhi's whereabouts during the time of the alleged motel encounter. The Moussaoui indictment lays out a tantalizing possible association between Atta and Moussaoui, but never puts the two in the same place at the same time. The link could exist, however, along a dusty Oklahoma roadside off Interstate 40 at a small motel that is indistinguishable from hundreds of others, except for its possible connection to terrorists. And that is very interesting indeed, and the evidentiary tributary running in the direction of the Oklahoma City bombing, also inspired by the Turner Diaries, is also very interesting. Recall that one of the aspects of the Oklahoma City bombing that has been effectively obscured is that, according to an ATF informer who passed a lie detector test, Carol Howe, Timothy McVeigh was acting on orders from Andreas Strassmeier, a former German Army intelligence officer, and the son of Andreas Strassmeier, Helmut Kohl's chief of staff and the architect of German reunification, which, played, by the way, took place on the Berlin Wall came down on November 9th of 1989, one of the dates viewed as propitious by the Nazis. And recall that the grandfather of Andreas Strassmeier and the father of Gunther was one of the charter members, one of the early members of the German Nazi Party in Germany. Also, I would recall that Timothy McVeigh was executed rather summarily in the spring of 2001. One wonders if perhaps people wanted to close his mouth. I would note that John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, obviously someone who is now known as an extreme right-winger, as we saw in For the Record 271, had interceded on behalf of a Dr. Sell, a Missouri dentist who had strong connections to paramilitary right-wing groups and had been plotting to murder a federal agent, which is a very interesting thing for an attorney general to be acting on behalf of. So again, I think some interesting questions need to be asked about John Ashcroft. In the late summer of 2003, there was a major power blackout that blacked out parts of Canada and also New York City and much of the American Northeast. Interestingly enough, a terrorist group that also took credit for bombings in Turkey and has alleged to be connected to Al-Qaeda took credit for those attacks. I don't know if, in fact, that is the case. I will add that material to the printed description, but we're not going to be able to cover it here due to lack of time. But I'm going to read an episode from the Turner Diaries, which I think has some very interesting implications for this country's future. It's about a plan to not only sabotage a nuclear power plant, but thereby to spread radiation and panic, and also to do tremendous economic damage to the United States by causing massive power failures in the industrial Midwest. From Chapter 16 of the Turner Diaries, we read, April 10th, 1993. This is the first time in a week I've had some time to myself and have been able to relax. I'm in a Chicago motel with nothing to do until tomorrow morning when I'll take a tour of the city of the Evanston Power Project. I flew out here Friday afternoon for two things, the Evanston tour and a delivery of hot money to one of our Chicago units. Skipping down, of course we have two other money presses running on the West Coast and we'll be setting up others in the near future. And if I can figure a way to take out the Evanston project, that'll be a capital loss of nearly $10 billion in one stroke, not to mention the economic damage which will result from the loss of electrical power to industrial plants throughout the Great Lakes region. We're skipping now and again. We want to hit the new nuclear power complex at Evanston during the next 6 weeks while they're still guiding tourists through it. After the 1st of June, it will be closed to the public permanently. Knocking it out will become much more difficult. The Evanston Power Project is an enormous thing. Four huge nuclear reactors surrounded by the biggest turbines and generators in the world. And the whole thing sits on concrete pilings a mile out in Lake Michigan, which supplies the cooling water for the reactor's heat exchangers. The project generates 18,000 megawatts of electrical power, almost 20 billion watts. Incredible. The power is fed into the power grid, which supplies the entire Great Lakes region. Before the Evanston project went into operation 2 months ago, the whole Midwest was suffering from a severe power shortage, much worse than we have here, which is bad enough. In some areas, factories were restricted to operating only 2 days a week, and there were so many unexpected blackouts in addition that the region was on the verge of a real economic crisis. If we can take out the new power plant, things will be even worse than they were before. In order to keep the lights on in Chicago and Milwaukee, the authorities will have to steal power from as far away as Detroit and Minneapolis, where there's none to spare. All of that part of the country will be hit hard, and it took 10 years to design and build the Evanston project, so they won't be able to remedy the situation very soon. But the government has thought about the consequences of losing the Evanston project, too, and the security there is pretty formidable. One can't get near the place except by boat or airplane, and there are searchlights, patrol boats, and strings of buoys with nets of cable between them all around it, which make the approach by water almost out of the question. Skipping down again, it seems to me that about the only way we could mount an attack on the place by conventional means would be to sneak some heavy mortars within range somewhere near the shore where there is a possibility for concealment. But to my knowledge, we don't have that kind of weaponry available at the moment. Anyway, the really vital parts of the power station are in such massive buildings that I doubt a mortar attack could inflict more than superficial damage. They then come to a decision to contaminate the nuclear power plant with radioactive material, thereby creating panic. Skipping down again, in essence, my idea is this. Since there's no way a single tourist can sneak in enough explosive material to wreck the place, nor any way he can position the small amount he could sneak in so it would be really effective, like punching a hole in one of the reactor pressure vessels, we may as well forget about explosives. Instead, we'll try to contaminate the plant with radioactive material so that it can't be used. What makes this idea feasible is that we have a source inside the organization for certain radioactive materials. We can easily pack enough of a really hot and nasty radionucleotide, something with a half-life of a year or so, into a cane or a crutch, together with a small explosive charge for dispersing it to make the entire Evanston Power Project uninhabitable. Skipping down. The whole plan is pretty scary, but it has one big advantage. The anti-nuclear lobby will have a field day with it. It will catch people's imagination to a far greater extent than any ordinary bombing or mortar attack. It will horrify many people, and it will knock many more of them off the fence. I must confess that I'm glad at this point that my probationary period still has 11 months to run, and that I won't be asked to volunteer for this particular mission. And it talks about the panic that will create, and that the anti-nuclear lobby will be used to help generate public panic in this regard. Consider the possibilities for the future. The Washington Post, Sunday, December 7th of 2003, article by Joby Warwick. Dirty bomb rockets vanish. It's Dateline Tiraspol in Moldova. In the ethnic conflicts that surround the collapse of the Soviet Union, fighters in several countries seized upon an unlikely new weapon, a small, thin rocket known as the Alazan. Originally built for weather experiments, the Alazan was transformed into a terror weapon, packed with explosives and lobbed into cities. Military records show that at least 38 Alazan warheads were modified to carry radioactive material, effectively creating the world's first surface-to-surface dirty bomb. The warheads are not known to have been used, but now, according to experts and officials, they have disappeared. It'd be interesting to see whether Islamo-fascists or perhaps some of their apparent white supremacist colleagues in the United States eventually get a hold of them. Yet another portent, perhaps, of things to come. This is from the L.A. Times of January 7th of 2004. Article by Scott Gold, Dateline Houston. Its headline, Domestic Terrorism Fight Comes Under Fire. It reads in part, one evening 2 winters ago, a man in Staten Island, New York, absent-mindedly flipped through his mail. Inside one envelope was a stack of fake documents, including United Nations and Defense Department identification cards and a note, we would hate to have this fall into the wrong hands. It had. The package, intended for a member of a self-styled militia in New Jersey, had been delivered to the wrong address. From that lucky break, federal officials believe they may have uncovered one of the most audacious domestic terrorism plots since the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing that killed 168 people. Starting with a single piece of mail, investigators discovered an enormous cache of weapons in Noonday in East Texas, including the makings of a sophisticated sodium cyanide bomb capable of killing thousands of people. And the three people arrested, William Krar, his common-law wife Judith Bruey, and Edward S. Feltus, appear to have had white supremacist connections and, links to some of the sort of anti-Semitic and Nazi types that were inspired by the Turner Diaries. Again, it may appear to people to be odd to have white supremacist or neo-Nazi elements in this country hooked up with people from the Middle East, but there are a number of historical tributaries, including the concept of the Earth Island envisioned by German geopoliticians, the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic fascist organization, and also recall the structural economic connections between the Bush milieu and the Middle Eastern oil-producing nations, and also the historical relationships between the Bush milieu and the Third Reich. We're going to conclude with a passage from the book Militant Islam Reaches America by Daniel Pipes. And in turn here, Daniel Pipes is accessing documents from the Hamas Charter. Listen to this, and if the possibility of Islamists and neo-Nazis hooking up sounds strange, just listen to this point of commonality from an ideological standpoint. The Hamas Charter sees Jews as the ultimate enemy. They have, quote, used their wealth to gain control of the world media, news agencies, the press, broadcasting stations, etc. They were behind the French Revolution and the Communist Revolution. They instigated World War I. They caused World War II. It was they who gave the instructions to establish the United Nations and the Security Council to replace the League of Nations in order to rule the world through them, unquote. So, again, it's not such a far stretch. WFMU archiving the For the Record shows, more recent programs streaming on Real Audio at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs available for download only on a longer URL. Link to both that website and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. There will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record Program 443 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. Listeners who have inquired about how to support the work that I'm doing will find a page on which they can click at the beginning of each description of the For the Record programs. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 443, The Serpent's Diaries, Part 2, subtitled Neo-Nazis and 9/11, being recorded on January 25th of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.